presented by Pharma.
Hey, good morning. I'm Playbook co-author Rachel Bade. It's Wednesday, May 29th, and here's what's driving the day. Jury deliberations for Trump's hush money case start today, with attorneys on both sides laying out and finishing their closing arguments yesterday. It was a long day, to say the least. Joining me now to talk about what he saw in the courthouse and what we should expect over the next few days is our senior legal affairs reporter, Kyle Chaney. Good morning, Kyle.
Hi, Rachel. Good to be with you.
So let's just start briefly by taking us through those final closing arguments yesterday, and if you got any sort of sense on who has the upper hand here.
Sure. Well, it's hard to do anything briefly about it when the closing arguments extended the entire day, which was just it was a slog. For us in the press room, certainly, because a lot of us had to line up outside the courthouse several hours before proceedings. But for the jurors, apparently seemed very engaged the whole time and didn't seem to be losing interest despite how long they ran. So it's hard.
And you were
to
there
read.
From probably what four or five a.m. till like what? 9,
around
4
a.m. until the proceedings finished at 8 p.m. They went late because the judge wanted to finish closing arguments in one day, and rather than split it up over two, so he let everyone stayed. So it was certainly the longest day of trial.
And so what was your reaction to what you heard?
So look, I think in any criminal case, the prosecution always has the upper hand. Convictions are the predominant result in criminal trials. In a high profile case like this, you know, conventional wisdom can sometimes go out the window. I think prosecutors have somewhat of an advantage because they get the last word with the jury. And the prosecutor in this case, as I mentioned, took an extremely long time to deliver his closing, almost 5 hours. And he went through every single piece of evidence they introduced throughout the trial and explained why it supported a guilty verdict. And he tried to answer some of the questions that the defense raised about the holes in the case or the credibility of key witnesses like Michael Cohen. Now, they spent a lot of time trying to shore up his credibility and also say, you know what, even if you don't trust Michael Cohen, we gave you so much other evidence, it doesn't matter. And by the way, all the things they're telling you about what a bad guy Michael Cohen is, remember, that's the guy Donald Trump wanted doing his dirty work. So maybe keep that in mind when you're judging, you know, whether he's a bad guy or not. So that was sort of their answer to a lot of the questions that Trump's team raised.
And what about the defense? I mean, do you think that they were able to land any last blows? What, there was this big, that final finish, something about Michael Cohen being the most valuable player in terms of being a liar. What was that line?
The MVP of liars.
Todd
Blanche used a few turns of phrase like that. I mean, Todd Blanche did the closing for Trump, and I think he went about 2 hours, maybe a little over 2 hours. He made the case clear that their defense rests almost entirely on Cohen. He had other points, but so much of his defense was Michael Cohen is a compulsive liar. He lies to everyone in every forum, Congress, the courts, his family, you know, his bank. And by the way, he lied to you when he was on the stand 2 weeks ago. And so it was just, that was the overwhelming focus of the defense case. And I think it was persuasive, and which is why the prosecutor spent so much time saying, you know what, even if you take their word for it, Cohen is not the only key to this case.
Yeah. So you told Playbook earlier this week that you expect a quick verdict, but with a caveat. What are you thinking in terms of timeline? What happens next in these deliberations?
The caveat, it's a big one, is that no one ever really knows what's happening in the jury's head. You know, you try to read their body language, you try to read their reactions to things. And this jury in particular has been hard to read. They're not really showing you overt facial expressions or responses to things. You know, with that said, you know, you also look at human nature to an extent. This trial's been going on a long time. Closing arguments were, as I mentioned, extremely long slog that they sat through all day and night. After a week off, they were basically didn't sit almost the entirety of the previous week. I think they seemed ready. They told the judge they were willing to stay till 8 p.m. to hear their end of closings. If they'd said they couldn't, he would have sent them home. They said they wanted to stay to fit the finish. So I think they're ready to start deliberating. They're going to finally have the case in their hands in a matter of a couple of hours once they get jury instructions. And, you know, I don't think it necessarily means they're going to blaze through it and have a quick unanimous verdict, you know, by lunchtime. But I do think they've had a lot of time to chew on this evidence, you know, even when they're not in session, that may lead to a quicker result.
So that's New York, but there was also some significant developments down in Florida with the classified documents case against Trump. So what happened down there? Give us a little bit of insight.
On Friday, Special Counsel Smith and his team put out some sort of late night request to the judge to impose a gag order on Trump for the limited purpose of stopping him from talking about this sort of outlandish claim that the FBI had marked him for assassination or had authorized people to shoot Trump on sight. It was this sort of wild and untrue and baseless accusation that Trump has used to gin up some anger among his supporters. And Smith's team says, you know, look, this is fomenting threats and a dangerous atmosphere for our agents and for our agencies. And so we think he should be barred from doing that. Trump's team fired back over the weekend and said, well, actually, the special counsel was supposed to reach out and ask our opinion before he filed this with you at first. Judge Cannon has made a point over and over again that anytime anyone in this case files anything, they have to first ask the other side, will you agree to this? Do you disagree? Can you give me your position on it? Will you do, you know, and to go through this sort of formal protocol. And they didn't do that in this case. So they did do it, but it was in such a barely reasonable way. They gave Trump's team 15 minutes to read the filing, say, do you want to, you know, submit a response? And before they even had a chance to respond, Smith's team filed this gag order request. And so Cannon saw this exchange of papers, rejected the gag order, and scolded Smith's team for basically ignoring her protocols for how to do this kind of thing. It's a little bit technical in the weeds about the filings, but the point is it was another eruption between the judge and the prosecution, just a sign that things are not going well for Smith's team down there, that doesn't seem in any mood to help them in their case in any way. And I just say another data point in the unlikelihood of this thing moving forward anytime soon.
Kyle, I've already kept you for too long, but I want to get your thoughts and reactions to a new New York Times story that really goes through the TikTok of this, what are they calling it, Alito Gate, upside down flag Alito Gate? Basically, the New York Times reported yesterday that the timeline Justice Alito and his wife have sort of articulated for flying this upside down flag after January 6th, initially saying it was in response to a neighbor who had used the C word in an argument with Justice Alito and his wife. Now it turns out that that timeline perhaps wasn't true. What do you think we can actually expect from this scandal, if anything?
Look, I think this is one of those scenarios where this is a little crass, but the cover-up ends up being worse than the crime. I mean, the upside-down flag, I mean, actually, maybe not necessarily, because the upside-down flag, especially at that time, in that moment in our country, if you can think back to how things were then, is sort of alarming, you know. But then to have this sort of conflicting story about how, you know, how that came to be, especially when Alito was kind of very dismissive of it at first and said, oh, it was this, you know, very simple, like, dispute among neighbors. To have that not be true or to have that called into doubt at such a fraught moment for the court as an institution, when there's already been these long-standing questions about Justice Thomas and his wife and her efforts to work with Trump and his team to try to overturn the election results and his refusal to recuse from things that are related to that. You know, it's another challenge to the legitimacy of that of the institution. You know, and it's another hot reminder that justices aren't really able to be held accountable in any real way.
Yep, really interesting stuff. And clearly, John Roberts, who always wants to keep the court out of the political mudsling, not able to do that.
Not sure how that's been working.
So, not well. Thanks, Kyle, for coming on.
Happy to be with you.
And for the rest of your schedule today, the Senate and the House are out. And the big story outside of New York, of course, is President Biden going to Philly, where he and Vice President Kamala Harris will attend two campaign events. The theme of the day, reaching out to Black voters who single-handedly delivered the nomination to Biden in 2020, but who are now turning against him. Can Biden win them back? We're going to see. I'm Rachel Bade. Thanks for listening.
The 340B drug pricing program is supposed to help vulnerable patients access medicines at qualifying hospitals and clinics. It's meant to be a safety net for those who really need it. Instead, 340B is padding the profits of PBMs, chain pharmacies, and big hospitals. Let's fix 340B so it can help the patients that need it most. Visit phrma.org/340b to learn more.